AI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. When we think of powerful and influential first ladies, Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton tend to come to mind before the often underestimated Lady Bird Johnson. Lady Bird was Lyndon Johnson's trusted political advisor and strategist, and beyond beautification projects, she initiated an ambitious national environmental effort. Julia Zweig had access to hundreds of hours of audio diary entries in Lady Bird's own voice, leading her in a new book from Random House called Lady Bird Johnson, Hidden in Plain Sight, to make the case that her subject was an accomplished politician and businesswoman in her own right. Julia Zweig is an award-winning author of books on Cuba, Latin America, and American foreign policy. She served as senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations for 15 years and is currently a senior research fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. She's also a producer and host of In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson, an 8-episode podcast that's produced with ABC News. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show now. Hello.
Hello. Happy to be with you today.
Now, your background is in foreign policy, and you've written books, as I said, about Cuba, Latin America. Why did you decide to write about Lady Bird Johnson? This seems like a major departure.
It's a major departure and an excellent question. And, you know, it kind of boils down to two things. One, after working on one set of issues for a very long time, I felt that I needed to teach myself something new. And I wanted to grow as a thinker and a writer and a historian. That's one. Two, and also that coincided with the Obama administration's commercial and diplomatic opening with Cuba, which is something that I had advocated for and worked very hard for behind the scenes for many years. So I felt like I had mission accomplished in a certain sense. But then also working in foreign policy for as long as I did, you know, I often found myself to be the only woman in the room. And that got me thinking about wanting to get my arms around the topic of women and power broadly. But I didn't have a subject. And I only found Lady Bird as my subject when I discovered that she had kept this vast, you know, I call them the other LBJ tapes, this vast documentary record of her time in the White House that was largely unexcavated. So I was a woman in search of a woman and found Lady Bird, who's, of course, associated with the American president, most associated with the word power. And it all just came together, Leonard. And
you were at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. So did that give you access?
Well, no, that's an affiliation. It's non-resident. I'm speaking to you from right outside of Washington, D.C. The access is not unique to me, but I think what is unique is that as far as I know, I'm the only person that's listened to all of the 123 hours and read all of the 1,700,000 words. Luckily, the library, the LBJ library, started releasing the fully unredacted tapes and transcripts right when I started sniffing around the Lady Bird topic as a potential topic for my next book.
So that's an awful lot of material, both written and spoken.
Yes, it is. But it's very compelling material. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to stick with it. I mean, go on. Sorry.
No, finish your thought.
No, my thought was that it was compelling because she's such a wonderful writer and her voice is so wonderful to listen to. It's got that East Texas lilt. She's her use of language is very precise and it adds so much to what we thought we knew about the Johnson presidency. It just compelled me to stick with her.
Why have you subtitled your book Hiding in Plain Sight? Well, I think that historians who've written about Lyndon Johnson, including Robert Caro, have minimized Lady Bird's role and influence? Or has Caro just not gotten to this part of her life because he still hasn't published the fifth volume of his LBJ books?
Well, yes and yes. I mean, one, the direct answer to your question is that the story has been missed. And we have this kind of two-dimensional mythology about Lady Bird as a pretty traditional first lady who was often treated poorly by Lyndon Johnson and who planted flowers. I mean, that's kind of the sum total of it. And the Caro treatment and that of almost every other major historian or journalist that's written about the Johnson White House years. And as you say, we're waiting for the fifth volume. The fourth of Caro's goes through the Civil Rights Act of July of 1964, pretty much sneezes past Lady Bird. And I think that's, so it's about the difference between who she really was and her influence and the mythology about those two things. But also, what's also hiding in plain sight is the source material. Is that material, even before the library started releasing it fully, had been published in a 1970 volume of about 780 pages. Not the best stuff, to be sure, but plenty there for anybody to get a sense by reading it that this was a person of formidable influence on LBJ. Plus, there's just so much other material, archival material, that fleshes out the case that I'm making. So I think because LBJ had, as Caro does write, a history of philandering and of treating her at times quite poorly in public, Lady Bird's in the public eye more a victim than as somebody with her own agency and influence. And so she's subordinate in the storytelling.
She was born Claudia Alta Taylor. Was there a reason that she never changed her childhood nickname?
Well, it stuck, and I don't know the answer to why she never changed it. I just know that as she became a fully developed woman and adult, she at times would have preferred to have been called Claudia, her given name, as opposed to Lady Bird, which was such a it didn't give the whole of the woman in terms of its fluffy sound. Mm-hmm.
Sounds very Texas. She was born 1912, and then when she was 5 years old, her mother died. How did her life change at that point?
Well, before her mother died, her mother had given Lady Bird a strong literary boost. She read to her. They played music and listened to music. She was a very cultured and educated woman, and she tried to pass that on to Lady Bird. But the death left Lady Bird not an orphan. She was raised by her father, who to my mind is a sort of Tennessee Williams character. She had two older brothers who were off to boarding school, and she wound up spending a great deal of time, as she talks about it, alone, and especially finding solace in nature. And she developed a very kind of in the bones sense of the importance of access to nature to make one feel fully human.
What do you mean when you say her father was like a Tennessee Williams character?
Well, I mean, he was this larger than life Southern boss kind of, dominated their East Texas town. They lived in a huge mansion called the Brick House. Lady Bird was raised in part by him, by an aunt, and by descendants of enslaved people. And he just has that kind of feel of a Tennessee Williams character.
She received two bachelor's degrees from the University of Texas in Austin in history and journalism. So did she plan to have a professional career?
She did. I mean, I think she was of two minds about it, right? She was done with her degrees by 1934, and she had dreams of maybe leaving Texas and going to what were not then states, Hawaii or Alaska, to become a teacher. On the other hand, she also thought maybe she would spend her time helping her father, redecorating her house, meet a nice young man, and settle down to a privileged lifestyle.
And was Lyndon Johnson a nice young man? They had a rather whirlwind courtship. And you said that she left school in 1934. That's the year they also got married. How did she meet?
Yes. They were introduced by a mutual friend, and he at that time was working as a congressional staffer in Washington. And he, had an eye for brilliant, low ego individuals. They met first at the Driscoll Hotel over breakfast in Austin, Texas, spent the day together. By the end of that first date, he asked her to marry him, and she was completely flabbergasted. She thought he was absolutely nuts.
But she said yes, eventually.
Well, yes. Then they had this rapid 6-week courtship. And in fact, the love letters between the two of them are also now published, or at least public. It went by very quickly, and he kind of, at the end of those 6 weeks, gave her an ultimatum. He said, you know, marry me now or we're done. Sounds very Johnsonian. And she did.
And then how soon after that did he wind up in Washington?
Well, not long after that. 1937 is his first congressional race, and they moved to Washington, D.C. And she is, I think, totally taken aback by the world of Washington politics and how consuming it was to be married to a man of his ambition.
But she continued her connection to Austin. She decided to use her own money to purchase an Austin radio station in 43 and then to expand and buy a television station. Was that an act of independence?
You know, she also used her own money, by the way, to finance his first congressional campaign. This is where we start to see the seeds of Lady Bird's ambition, right? She loves LBJ, and she sees that she has a choice, right? Get on board or be extremely unhappy. And I think one of the themes that comes out from the book and more generally is that they have a joint political and business enterprise, and they start weaving it together first with the congressional race, but then much more seriously so with the acquisition of KTBC, the radio station. And she starts, I think, as much of a package as LBJ was to be married to really enjoy the ways in which he relied on her and stretched her. And so, yes, she puts her family money into the business and then spends years driving back and forth between DC and Austin, keeping the books, bringing that business. You know, he trades on his power and influence to get the FCC license, but she's keeping an eagle eye on the money side of it and the staffing side of it. So that's the ambition coming to fore.
The business became somewhat controversial, didn't it? Didn't Lyndon use his influence in the Senate to pressure the Federal Communications Commission into granting the franchise a monopoly license?
Yes, that's what I was just referring to. Yeah. He absolutely did. And it was controversial. I'm not saying she's exempt from the controversy. I'm saying that she was a participant in this commingled enterprise. So if he was able to strong arm the FCC, that benefited her and benefited them.
And Republicans try to embarrass them as a result. Was LBJ involved with running the stations, or were they strictly under her control?
You know, here I'll have to credit the research and writing that Caro has done on this matter, because it's at a certain point, the answer to your question becomes opaque. The documents that show who did what and the money and the business side of their media enterprises are closed. So I can't give you more than we got from early Wall Street Journal pieces and Caro's reporting himself. And the basic truth is that who had how much influence on one piece of it, I think, is hard to say.
But the franchise was so successful that the Johnsons became millionaires many times over.
Yes, I'm going to forget the number because I don't retain numbers well. But by the time they come into the White House in 1963, it's a multi-million dollar enterprise.
My guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large is Julia Zweig, author of Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight, published by Random House. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. How did Lady Bird come to play a significant part in the Johnson political machine beyond what she was doing with radio and television?
Well, I think we can go back to World War II to answer your question, but I don't want to give you the beat by beat. The short of it is that especially once World War II was upon the country and FDR made the decision to allow members of Congress to enlist, LBJ left Washington for a time, a short time, during which, and he went to the Pacific and to California, Lady Bird ran his congressional office. She
did you have a formal title?
Excuse me? No formal title. Hmm. But, you know, she basically was, for all intents and purposes, the chief of staff. And he kept a very close hold on it, but he was very far away, and they worked together. But even before that, she was helping with developing his donor base, servicing constituents, traveling around with them when they came to Washington, minding various constituent projects back in Texas. She had a couple of daughters, as you know, in the second part of the 1940s, which complicated her life in the sense that becoming the consummate political spouse and partner became a lot harder. But by the time he moves into the Senate and becomes Senate Majority Leader, especially, that status confers to Lady Bird. And she's really the ruler of the roost of Senate spouses, which in Washington at the time and probably still now is a place where intelligence is gathered and spread and received. And she continues to play an extremely active role on the social side of the LBJ political operation, meaning their evenings are occupied by all kinds of activities, whether at their home or outside. And she's still very much involved in the business in Texas, and they acquire the LBJ Ranch, which she begins to renovate and develop.
On top of that, weren't there times when she ran his congressional office, although she didn't get any title?
Yeah, that's what I mentioned earlier on about during his service in World War II.
Being married to LBJ couldn't have been easy. Wasn't he subject to frequent bouts of depression and insecurities?
Well, that's one of the themes of both the book and the podcast. And I say the podcast, Leonard, as well, because there the listener is able to listen to Lady Bird talk about his perennial depression. So he was a person that was insecure and thin-skinned and charismatic and brilliant and suffered from what I think we would characterize today as pretty classic anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And for her, that meant that he really relied on her and that she had to keep herself well and healthy and together in order to be able to help him get out of his funks and to endure those funks when they happened.
And then he had a heart attack in 1955. Yep. Did he ever fully recover from that? He was only 46 at the time.
Well, he was a heavy drinker and smoker and had probably made terrible nutritional choices, as many Americans did at the time. He did recover from it, but that heart attack almost killed him. And he went back to the ranch for several months to recover afterwards. And it represented a really important turning point with them in the sense that afterward, the two of them were constantly concerned that he would die an early death because of heart failure, as his uncles and father had as well. And in fact, he did, but it colors his health. He stopped drinking for the most part by the time he was in the White House and smoking for sure. But they lived under constant fear that he might become incapacitated while in the White House or not live to serve a full two terms were he to stay for a second term.
Mm-hmm. So that was part of their decision about whether he should run or not. We'll get to that in a little while.
Okay.
How much did she know about his frequent extramarital affairs, and how did she handle it?
Well, look, I assume that she knew a great deal about them. And from all the research I've done, what I can tell you is that the matter of his affairs had, as I said earlier, sort of painted her as essentially his victim. The way she handled it was heavy compartmentalization. There were dalliances that were sexual in nature, which from what I can tell, she did her best to ignore. On the other hand, there were affairs that were serious with women of substance. And in some cases, she made her best to, I think she couldn't help but see why he might have been attracted to them. It's a curious notion because it almost sounds kind of really, really modern, but my take on their marriage of 30 years by the time they get into the White House is that his dependence on her was quite total. She derived an enormous amount of power from the marriage and the political and economic enterprise, and that the philandering was all the piece of that totality. And I'll tell you why that's where I land on this. And yes, I mean, so the answer is she was aware of them and she had a way of dealing with them. When another person was writing her biography in the 1990s, Lady Bird Johnson cut off contact with her, this woman, the biographer, and said, you'll never understand, because there was an effort maybe to spend too much time on the affairs and the sex part. Lady Bird said, you'll never understand me if you don't understand how totally intertwined our lives were with one another. So I take my cue from her about how she handled it in terms of the totality of the marriage and what it was to them.
And then divorce would have been a real problem for politically because it would have ruined his political career. We didn't
that's for sure, but who knows if divorce was even on the table?
Hmm. Well, you mentioned that some of those women were really people of substance. For example, his affair with Helen Gehagan Douglas was pretty famous, California congresswoman, and that was an open secret on Capitol Hill.
Yes, it was going on in the 1940s, and then when she ran for Senate in California, Richard Nixon went after her with sort of vicious McCarthyite smear tactics. Lyndon came to her defense while he was in the Senate. She had been very close to the Roosevelts. She was a very famous actress, very brilliant, very beautiful. And Lady Bird has this one episode that she recounts in her diaries in which she wakes up. It's 1964. And she says, Lyndon had loaned my robe and nightgown to Helen Gehagan Douglas. And he took off and went to New York. And we spent the most marvelous morning together. And she's reciting poetry about Helen Gehagan Douglas and talking to her about this compellingly brilliant and beautiful woman. It's kind of stunning, but it's a tell about this choice she made to see some of them and ignore the others.
Well, why do you think Lady Bird included that story when she usually kept quiet about his infidelities?
Well, like I said, I think it's her way of, look at these diaries, these tapes were her awareness of her participation and importance in Johnson presidential history. And that's why I say it's a little confounding. It sounds kind of weirdly modern for a woman who was born in the early part of the 20th century. I think she was telling us that she had the capacity to metabolize complexity generally and in dealing with LBJ.
What was her relationship with Jacqueline Kennedy like when Jackie was first lady and she was a second lady? Because these two women were very different.
Well, they were very different. But in a sense, you know, that difference, their relationship goes back to the 1950s when the Johnsons were majority leader and the Kennedys were younger and newer to Washington, first to the House and then Jack in the Senate. When Lady Bird, with her seniority, tries to bring Jackie in and help her get into the groove of being a Senate spouse, which is not Jackie's thing so much. However, when the script flips and the Johnsons join the Kennedy ticket in 1960, now as VP, Lady Bird basically makes herself indispensable to Jackie, both on the campaign trail as Jackie's surrogate, campaigning all over the country and all over Texas with Jackie's sisters-in-law and mother-in-law, winning Texas, as Bobby Kennedy said, for the Kennedy ticket. And then as second lady also, when Jackie is not as enthralled by the rope line and the ceremonial and all of the other duties of first lady and asks Lady Bird to step in. And Lady Bird does very, very often. They have a kind of intimate understanding of one another. And again, sort of belying the mythology, which says that there was just, it was all tension and all disdain, Kennedy to Johnson. What I found in the documents that I read in the Kennedy Library and the Johnson Library was a far more intimate and amicable dynamic when Lady Bird was second lady and Jackie first lady.
But then came two assassinations, first JFK and then Robert Kennedy, and that affected their relationship as well. Well, of course it did.
Well, I mean, the first assassination, that of JFK, and here I should say again, referencing the podcast, the very first LBJ tape, the other LBJ tape, Lady Bird's tape, the first audio diary entry she makes, she records 8 days after November 22nd, 1963. And it's
after
a
JFK
beat by
was
beat,
shot.
Correct, beat by beat, very dramatic, very poignant, very emotional description of that day. And the 14-day transition thereafter from the assassination until the day Jackie moves out of the White House with her kids and the Johnsons move in. And what you see, what you hear is a kind of excruciatingly careful and sensitive transition that Jackie and Lady Bird together orchestrate.
Why do you think she switched to doing audio diaries rather than writing out the diary? How different were they?
Well, no, there was no switch. She started as an audio diary from the get-go. She was a consummate note taker. She took notes in Greg's shorthand, and she always had these little spiral notebooks with her, including on Air Force One coming back from Dallas to Washington. She's making notations that she then uses for her audio recording. But, you know, she's a modern media woman. This is, she thought of herself as a media executive, and after all, she was. So the idea of recording was a very modern take. And also because, you know, the word diary, it's kind of, you know, dear diary, today, it's kind of a feminized idea. These were tapes. This was her record of her experience in the White House. And she amassed all kinds of material and she would sit with it. LBJ's daily diary, her daily diary, that's the technical term for their schedule. Memos, guest lists, sometimes eye glazing and not so interesting, but some press clips of the day. But that question about why did she switch, it wasn't that she switched, it's that she understood the power of audio.
Well, along those lines, you suggested that people also listen to your podcast, which is called In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. Do you recommend listening to the podcast before or after we read the book?
Well, some people do both. And I wouldn't want to dissuade people from reading the book, but I would just say that this is a two-part multimedia effort to show the totality of her and her story. And so what you can't bring to life in a book is the way she sounded. And of course, the podcast is also full of contemporaneous archival material from the time. So it's more like an audio documentary. I'll leave it to listeners to choose and recommend both.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. Well, we haven't left Julia Zweig, whose latest book is called Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. It's published by Random House. She's also the author of Friendly Fire, Losing Friends and Making Enemies in the Anti-American Century, and Inside the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro and the Urban Underground. And as we've been pointing out, she's also the host of a new 8-episode podcast produced with ABC News called In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. Now, despite his popularity with the public, why was LBJ ambivalent about running for a full term in 1964? My sense of him was that he was a very ambitious man.
He was ambitious, but I think that, again, sort of complexity is the word of the day on the Johnsons. He was ambitious, but he had a lot of doubt about his ability, even if he were to win and win well in 1964, to then keep the country unified over the period of time that would become his first term. And that was for two reasons. I mean, one is, early 1964, there were already 16,000 American troops in Vietnam. We call them advisors. There were already 300 Americans dead there. He did not. And so Vietnam to him and to both of them was something that stood there as this potentially derailing piece of the presidency that could derail their domestic agenda, which was very progressive and very ambitious, to use your word. So I think he doubted his ability to figure out Vietnam, and he sure was right about that. The second is that the awareness of his being from the South, not having the elan of the Northern elite that the Kennedys had, being derided constantly in what we would call, say, the mainstream press, and his own personality of the combination of insecurity and ambition, it all added up to, and also just the feeling of coming to office illegitimately, or at least in a way that didn't allow him to win a proper election, if not illegitimately, through assassination. It all added up to doubt over whether he was really the right person to be in office in the wake of Kennedy's assassination.
So did he turn to his wife for advice about the decision? Because about the strategy memos that she wrote for him, laying out the pros and cons.
Yes. And this this document that you're referring to, Leonard, which I took the liberty of renaming and calling it the Huntland Strategy Memo, was sitting in the LBJ library for years in a file called Letters, Mrs. Johnson to Lyndon Johnson, or to President Johnson. And it's a 9-page handwritten document that precisely does what you said. It lays out the pros and cons of running or not running. It also includes a statement that Lady Bird wrote, which Lyndon would read to the public to say that he was getting out of politics, so that he would hear himself and feel what it would feel like to get out of the arena. In 64, he asked her in May of 64, at a time when civil rights was stuck in the Congress, when the war on poverty legislation hadn't passed, McNamara was coming back from his 5th trip to Vietnam and pushing LBJ to escalate. He says, well, what do you think? Please write this out for me. And she does. And what's so significant in it, well, there are many pieces that are significant, but the key thing is this. She says, you know, you're too young to get out of politics. I don't want you to go back to the ranch. You'll be at a loss and I'll have to deal with that. And I don't want that. But she says, but also what you should do is run and you'll very likely win. And then in February or March of 1968, you can announce to the world that you won't be running for a second term. And that is precisely what happens. Although when they announce it in March, on March 31st, 1968, everybody but the two of them are completely taken aback because, as you say, they think of LBJ as this endlessly ambitious man. And what president would walk away from power? What person would walk away from the power of the presidency? But that was the plan. And you see, and one hears and reads in the transcripts or listens and tracks it against everything else that was happening, that that strategy was something she worked to execute from the day he was elected and inaugurated then, and stepping up most especially by the end of 1967 when Lady Bird pushes for LBJ to come up with a date certain when he's going to make the statement that he won't run again.
Now, during his first year in office, LBJ had no vice president. Haven't some suggested that Lady Bird kind of filled that role for him?
Well, some could be me. I mean, we stumbled across some really fun news clips from 1964 when she goes on one of her poverty tours to Kentucky, where the local press refer to her as Mrs. Vice President. Somewhat jokingly, a bit tongue-in-cheek, but the press corps also covering her, the National Press Corps traveling with her, they see that, in fact, Lady Bird is standing in as LBJ's surrogate in lots of ways that a vice president would. And so they call her Mrs. Vice President. Lady Bird laughs it off, but she does show up in so many ways in that role. So it's a metaphor. It's not literal.
Could that situation happen again? Doesn't the 25th Amendment provide for a clearer line of succession?
Yes, but that did not pass. That had not yet passed in 1964.
Now, when she was campaigning for him in 64, she made a solo campaign train trip with stops in 8 Southern states. And didn't many Southerners express their displeasure with LBJ's civil rights policies by protesting her speeches, including bomb threats? Sounds like today.
All of the above. She was a Southerner. You know, she was not just a Texan, but she had grown up also spending her summers, as she says, 25 miles from the Edmund Pettus Bridge at her family's home, her mother's side of the family, in Alabama. She deeply understood the potential for a white backlash against LBJ, against the Democratic Party, and certainly against civil rights legislation. But she didn't want, you know, LBJ famously tells Bill Moyers after the Civil Rights Act passes, "I think we've just lost the South for my lifetime and yours." And he was onto something there. But Bird, as he called her, didn't want to lose the South by default. So she decided, along with her chief of staff, Liz Carpenter, and LBJ, although against the recommendation of LBJ's own people, some of whom were Kennedy holdovers, to go to the South. And after the convention in Atlantic City in August of 68, she goes and she campaigns in the West. And then in October, she spends 4 days, 47 stops, 8 states of the South campaigning for his reelection and for the new South and for the people in the South to embrace the civil rights ethos that her husband was trying to push through. And she got death threats.
Yeah, she got death threats. You mentioned her chief of staff. Wasn't she the first first lady to have a press secretary and a chief of staff of her own? Now, after that, everyone has had one or two.
Yes, and that's, I mean, Liz Carpenter is really key. And she was herself a journalist who met Lady Bird when she, Liz, came to Washington on a high school trip when Lady Bird was running the congressional office of Lyndon. And Carpenter, who was also, as I said, a Texan, started covering Eleanor as a Cub reporter at those teas that Eleanor Roosevelt used to have for the female press corps. She was one of the only people, maybe other than Lady Bird, in the White House who had the clout and standing to speak truth to LBJ. And she was really the bridge who, with Lady Bird, knit together the East Wing and the West Wing as a political operation. And having a chief of staff and a press team and a policy team were innovations that make Lady Bird very unique and have not, I think, been properly credited to her in terms of modernizing the office of the First Lady.
Now, LBJ's political legacy is split. There are on the right, there were people who objected to his civil rights policies, and on the left, there were people who objected to the growing involvement in the Vietnam War. Where did she stand on both of those?
Well, on civil rights, as we were just talking about, you know, she kind of understood in her bones that leveling the racial playing field in this country was an essential part of the Great Society and an essential need to make true on our claims to democracy. She was all in on civil rights. On Vietnam, I was going to say, on Vietnam, she really had the blinders that LBJ did, which is to say 3 points. One, she really bought into the geopolitics of the Cold War and in the wake of World War II, really believed that one doesn't betray an ally as corrupt as they might be. So that notion of leaving Saigon to the communists was something that was unthinkable. I mean, that wasn't ideology to her. That was truth. Second, LBJ had been essential in the development of bringing electricity to Texans, to poor Texans. And so they had this kind of Wilsonian idealism, Leonard, which was, wow, if we can do that in Texas, why not in the Mekong Delta? It's that American exceptionalism that they were really steeped in. And third is that they were really insecure about on foreign policy grounds and didn't know how to not escalate.
But also she wanted to bring those ideas to Washington, D.C., a very segregated city. And she did interesting things. She worked with a landscape architect, Lawrence Halprin, to develop a large public recreation space aimed more for D.C. residents than for tourists. And she also, but in order to build that, a proposed D.C. highway project would have had to have been rerouted. And she worked behind the scenes to oppose that.
Yes, I mean, her environmental ambition and the complexity of it was, I think, totally underestimated because it was called beautification. But behind that, as you said, was an attempt to knit together civil rights, access to nature, what we would think of today as environmental justice, not just on the highways and not just with flowers along the parkways, all of which is gorgeous and important, but in American cities and in communities of color that had been most victimized and damaged by new highway construction from the federal highway bills that had passed in the 50s and from urban renewal.
My guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large is Julia Sweig, S-W-E-I-G. Her latest book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight, published by Random House. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. She didn't like the word beautification, did she?
No, I mean, how could she? It was a euphemism, and it was, like her own name, sort of prissy sounding. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, she's got this line I found her set to have said when she was an older woman in her 1980s and partially blind. She was speaking to a notable environmental writer, nature writer, activist, Terry Temple Williams. Terry Temple Williams was in Austin at a spa on a book tour. And it was one of those arrangements where if you come and speak and give a book talk, you can come stay at our spa for a couple of days. So she tells this story about going to give her a book talk, and there's only two women in the audience, and they're sitting there in their robes and on their wheelchairs. And she gives her talks, and she realizes that one of them is Lady Bird Johnson, and the other one is Liz Carpenter. The Lady Bird listens to her and gives her her critique of the way she, Terry, is using language to describe nature to inspire people to want to protect it. And Lady Bird diverges and says, "I'll never forgive Lyndon's boys for making me call my environmental agenda beautification." But I did it because I thought if people appreciated the flowers, they would come to appreciate and want to protect the land that grew them. So the beautification euphemism was about politics, and it was about the sense of where public consciousness was around the environment. But she instructed her staff, starting in about 1967, to tell everyone to stop using that word. And she started just talking about what she really meant, which was this connection between mental health and access to nature and jobs and housing for communities most hit by the inequalities in American cities.
And some of her goals weren't accomplished during LBJ's term. Richard Nixon, for example, established the EPA, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. Some other things came even later, although we're still fighting over global warming and some of the things that would have concerned her. As the First Lady during the beginning of the Women's Liberation Movement and as a mother of two daughters, how did she encourage women to pursue their own careers?
She, again, back to sort of the two-dimensionality of Lady Bird, I would have been surprised if you had told me when I started this to learn about her that she was any kind of a feminist. But she had a kind of unmistakable feminism. And again, sort of in that period of 1964, when we refer to her as Mrs. Vice President, at that same time, she makes an effort to show and elevate the importance of women as professionals. She hosts a series of luncheons at the White House. They're called Doers Luncheons. She brings Jane Jacobs, one of the premier urban activists at the time. She brings Barbara Solomon, who's one of the founders of the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe, to talk about the importance of documenting one's experiences. And she makes a number of speeches also in 1964, which are very feminist in their ethos, but they kind of don't get noticed because they're delivered with this cloak of Southern ladies' subterfuge.
Now, she had an exchange with Eartha Kitt about the war, which is not one of the nicer moments in her life.
Oh, it's the worst moment of the White House years, I think.
Can you tell
Eartha
us a bit
Kitt
about it?
Is, yes, of course. It becomes the second to the last Doers Luncheon of the White House, of Lady Bird's White House time. By January of 1968, which is when it takes place, the White House is now under an enormous amount of pressure. There's protests on American campuses over Vietnam in the streets. There are uprisings by Black communities in 300 cities around the country over the course of 3 years over police brutality and lack of housing and general discriminatory conditions. And there's a lot of pressure going into the 1960 election season on LBJ to become a kind of law and order president. And he's putting forth a new crime bill, a crime bill that, in fact, many people trace back to many of the worst incursions of police departments around the country today. But in any case, Lady Bird hosts a discussion called Crime in Our Streets, and she wants to put the East Wing's political outreach behind passage of that law that Lyndon is promoting in Congress. So she invites a bunch of people to come and speak and others to participate in the discussion, one of whom is Eartha Kitt. And Eartha Kitt at the time is starring as Catwoman in Batman. She's a world-famous dancer, performer, singer. And she's also, and many people don't know this about her, she's also an activist. She's been working with youth empowerment groups in Watts and also in Anacostia. She's testified in Congress about it. And she comes to about kids and kids of color, especially, and the conditions they face in growing up and the conditions they would need to grow up in better circumstances. And so she comes to the White House as Lady Bird's guest and does the unconscionable thing of, first, when Lyndon comes, he comes by to say hello. And as he's leaving, she stands up and stops him. And she asks him a question. And this is a violation of protocol and choreography for a White House event. But he handles it just fine. Then, however, during the Q&A of the discussion among the ladies, Lady Bird calls on Eartha. And Eartha stands up and gives a very long statement, which is kind of all over the place. But the gist of it is, she brings Vietnam into the discussion. She says, you want to understand why people are committing crimes, why they're protesting, why they're in the streets. It's because of Vietnam. They'd rather go to jail at home, well, they'll get a square meal, than be sent off to war to die. And she really tries to bring together what's happening in American streets with the war abroad. And the controversy that ensues afterward is very much fed by the White House spin machine, and it winds up damaging her Eartha Kitt's career for decades to come.
Now, we're pretty much out of time, but I do want to point out that when Lady Bird addressed the graduating class at Williams College, people walked out before she could give the speech. So there was an awful lot of opposition. Bobby Kennedy became a prominent public critic of the war as well. And then LBJ died just a few years after he left office. Did she remain active in many of the causes that had interested her?
I think it was that experience at Williams that finally turned the worm for her in terms of seeing definitively that the Vietnam War had made their presidency unsustainable, by the way. Just to jump ahead then, she continued with her environmentalism in Texas and in Austin is the short answer.
And how can people access your podcast?
Is it anywhere available? People listen to podcasts, Apple or iHeartRadio. I think it's on every platform.
Spotify,
maybe not iHeart, but definitely Spotify. You can listen to it there in plain sight.
And thank you for talking with us today on WBAI. Julia Zweig, her latest book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight, published by Random House. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me. Likewise. Have a great day.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to Deborah Freeman for preparing today's interview and to our live engineer, Reggie Johnson, and my executive producer, Jesse Lent, for all the important work that they do throughout the week. If you would like to hear more of our one-hour interviews on one subject, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. And we're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else that podcasts are available. And there are links to our more than 500 past shows on our website, LeonardLopateAtLarge.com. If you'd like to write to me, my email address is LeonardLopate@WBAI.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep the show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. We're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to step up and make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by going online to give to WBAI.org or by calling 212-209-2950 right now. And consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy. We need your help to keep bringing you this unique in-depth content because WBAI is sponsored 100% by listener donations. So please step up right now by going online to give to WBAI.org or by calling 212-209-2950 to keep this historic station, the only one on the New York radio dial that's entirely listener sponsored, on the air by making a tax-deductible donation. And I'm sure you can understand the station needs your help now more than ever after all of what's happened over the past year. So to everyone who has already stepped up to support WBAI in the name of Leonard Lopate at large, we thank you very much. And I'm counting on many more to join them and become members as well.
Oh, the streets of Rome are filled with rubble. Ancient footprints.
Folk Radio this Thursday night, June 10th at 10 p.m., a tribute to Bob Dylan, with performances by Stevie Wonder, Tracy Chapman, June Carter Cash and Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Chris Christopherson, Richie Havens, the Clancy Brothers, Mary Chapin Carpenter, Roseanne Cash and Sean Colvin, Neil Young, Chrissy Hynde, Eric Clapton, The Band, George Harrison, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Roger McGuinn, and eventually Bob himself joins them on stage. That's this Thursday night, June 10th at 10 p.m. on Folk Radio here on WBAI.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. In their first face-to-face meeting, President Biden and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed a 21st century version of the historic Atlantic Charter, an attempt to depict their countries as the chief global leaders taking on the world's biggest challenges. The two leaders pledged to work closely with all partners who share our democratic values and to counter the efforts of those who seek to undermine our alliances and institutions, end quote. The charter encompasses a commitment to cooperate on climate change, technology, and science. It also reaffirms support for NATO, while underscoring opposition to election interference and disinformation campaigns. The document is a symbolic nod to the original Atlantic Charter, signed in 1941 by former American President Franklin D. Roosevelt and former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Biden hopes to use this trip as president to reassure European allies that the United States had shed the tendencies of Donald Trump's term and is a reliable partner again. The Keystone XL pipeline is officially canceled. The developer of the controversial project announced it is pulling the plug after the Biden administration revoked its permit in January. The Keystone XL pipeline was expected to carry 830,000 barrels per day of crude oil from the oil sand fields of western Canada to Nebraska. But the project was delayed for the past 12 years due to opposition from U.S. landowners, Native American tribes, and environmentalists. The demise of XL comes as other North American oil pipelines, including Dakota Access and the Enbridge Line 3 in Minnesota, face continued opposition from environmental groups. The Louisiana State Police Unit, involved in the 2019 fatal arrest of Ronald Green, is now reportedly the subject of an internal investigation into whether troopers have repeatedly targeted and abused black drivers. The Associated Press reported today that four people familiar with the probe confirmed its existence and said the investigation includes Green's killing and three other of the department's violent encounters with black men. The investigation is focused on white officers with State Police Troop F, a notorious unit in northeastern Louisiana, whose officers have mislabeled body camera videos, turned off their cameras during arrests, and otherwise worked to hide evidence from investigators. Republican Representative Byron Donalds of Florida expressed frustration today at being prevented from entering the Congressional Black Caucus without a clear indication why. In an interview on CNN, Donalds said his office has not really heard much from the CBC in the months since he expressed interest in joining the group, and that no one has communicated why he is being kept out. A BuzzFeed News report pointed to Donald's support of former President Donald Trump and his decision to challenge the 2020 presidential election results as factors why he is being shut out. But other black GOP members, namely Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and former Representative Will Hurd of Texas, have notably declined to join the CBC. Fire crews are battling two massive wildfires in eastern Arizona that have consumed more than 177,000 acres. The fire comes as climate scientists say the western worst drought in one dry cycles and